All Eyes on Alcoa.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Alcoa is Wall Street's shiny object of the day. It's the first day of the second quarter, and the aluminum giant is the first Dow-listed company to report quarterly earnings. Doug Foreman is the director of equities at Highmark Capital in San Francisco. He joins us live. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Stacey.
So I get the sense that investors are hoping to see sort of how the second quarter is going from Alcoa and how the economy in general is doing. No offense to aluminum, but is Alcoa really a good bellwether?
Well, right now, I'd say normal times, Alcoa is a decent indicator of how things are going. But right now, I think investors are pretty well aware of the fact that pricing is very weak in aluminum and inventories are too high and demand's been very soft over the last 12 months. So we're not expecting much from Alcoa. Probably lose money, and the question is how much.
What companies or sectors are you going to be watching this quarter to get a sense of how the economy's doing?
Well, I think the banks are still key to look at. I mean, the ones that are left standing anyway, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank America, looking at their earnings are going to be important. We want to look for continued recovery there. And then I think in some of the other areas like tech and healthcare, names like Cisco and Intel and Microsoft, companies that, you know, aren't way out of whack in terms of supply-demand will be important. And most importantly, what they say about the outlook and their businesses will be very important going forward.
So the group of eight is meeting this week, and the G8 countries are set to talk about the global economy today. Is there anything that can come out of that meeting that would make you feel better?
Well, I think what they'll probably do is just continue to talk about how we're not out of the woods yet globally, that they still need to engage in recovery efforts worldwide. This has definitely been a global meltdown the last 12 months. And so I would expect them to continue on that path, which they've been on, and point out that they don't believe that we're out of the woods yet, which I would concur with.
Doug Foreman is the director of equities at Highmark Capital in San Francisco. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Stacey.
So maybe it's just that it's the dawn of a new quarter, but the markets seem to be in good spirits this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 0.4%. The NASDAQ is up 0.6%. The S&P 500 also up 0.5%. Overseas markets, not such a good day. They were down across the board. Total world domination. Well, total web domination. Microsoft and Google are battling it out. A month ago, Microsoft launched a search engine called Bing, which was a direct assault on Google. And in a blog posting late last night, Google announced plans to get serious about its operating system. Take that, Windows. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
It'll be called Google Chrome OS. OS stands for operating system, the standard software that controls a PC. Google said in an official blog post that its new operating system would be defined by its speed, simplicity, and security. This latest move by Google is aimed at Microsoft's jugular. The operating system is at the heart of computing, and it's the foundation of Microsoft's business model. The announcement has already raised questions about Google's dominance in computing. Google CEO Eric Schmidt says his company's focus is consumer choice. He spoke to Marketplace's Kai Rizdal in an interview recorded last week.
We feel that as long as we are really focused on consumer benefit, in other words, if the action we take really does benefit the average consumer, that the rest of the industry, the rest of the government, will get around that because consumers speak in democracies.
Google Chrome OS will first appear on netbooks in the second half of 2010. No response or blog posts yet from Microsoft. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
You're listening to The Morning Report for Wednesday, July 8th at Marketplace.org. As of 6 a.m. Central Time this morning, workers at a Chrysler assembly plant in Belvidere, Illinois, are back on the job. The plant, like all Chrysler factories, has been shut down since the automaker went into bankruptcy protection at the end of April. But it's reopening earlier than expected as Chrysler races to get back on its feet. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
thank the government's auto task force. Thank Fiat. Jesse Toprak at Edmunds.com says it doesn't matter who you thank. Just under a month after emerging from bankruptcy, Chrysler is moving faster than many thought possible.
I think that they've emerged with minimal damage. And we've also, interestingly, seen that the idea that people will not buy from a bankrupt company is simply not accurate. We've actually seen that bankruptcy was probably one of the best promotions Chrysler could have come up with. In fact, their sales went up.
Those sales and a complete factory shutdown means dealerships are running out of cars. Joe Philippi says that's one reason factories are reopening so soon. He's president of Auto Trends Consulting.
Dealers are running out of inventory of certain products that are doing well in the marketplace.
Analysts say keeping sales up during the reorganization is going to be key. Chrysler needs the cash to keep the engine running until it can start selling Fiat's cars in the United States. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The G8 summit in Italy begins today amid reports of disorganization and pending protests. After the April earthquake that killed 300 in the Italian region of Abruzzo, Italy decided to move the summit location from a coastal island to the badly damaged town of L'Aquila. The idea was to draw attention to the plight of the survivors and provide economic stimulus. As Megan Williams reports, it's been a risky move.
The goal of this week's G8 in Italy is to fuel the commitment to fighting hunger, curbing carbon emissions, and promoting economic growth. The preparations, though, have fueled resentment. Italy decided to hold the G8 in the earthquake-destroyed town of L'Aquila, supposedly to help pump money into the region through foreign joint ventures. 50,000 earthquake survivors are still homeless, many in tents. Recently, earthquake tremors in the area have prompted more people to leave their homes. The homeless complain the government has ignored their plight at the expense of the G8 preparations, while everyone from foreign delegations to opposition politicians grumble about lack of focus.
Berlusconi, tutto occupato.
Instead of preparing the agenda for the G8, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been chasing skirts, said opposition leader Antonio Di Pietro, referring to the recent scandal involving Italy's leader and escorts. In L'Aquila, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
British bankers are bracing themselves for a crackdown on bonus pay and lending practices. Later today, the British government will unveil its plans to regulate the UK's financial industry. From London, Stephen Beard has more.
The British government says that huge bank bonuses were a major factor in the credit crisis. They were often tied to the short-term performance of the bank's share price, and that encouraged too much risky lending. In the future, the government wants to see bonuses paid out over longer periods and linked to the long-term profitability of the banks. The government's also proposing new curbs on lending to prevent asset bubbles. Leslie MacLeod of the British Bankers Association says the government should tread warily. Too many curbs might drive some banks out of Britain.
It's one of those cases where things just chase the money. So you could see perhaps a bank like Barclays or HSBC thinking about whether or not they want to remain quartered in the UK.
But having spent more than $1.5 trillion of public money propping up the bulk of the UK banking industry, the government feels the voters will accept nothing less than a crackdown. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
American businesses start bringing home their latest report cards today. It's a new earnings season, and Alcoa is the first company on the Dow Index to report its second quarter profits. For Wall Street investors, the next few weeks may all come down to this. How well has corporate America played the expectations game? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
For the most part, business executives have been offering a relatively bleak outlook, and that's caused analysts to set their sights low. So even a slide in profits could be viewed as a positive sign, so long as the news isn't awful. Ted Weisberg is head of Seaport Securities. He says Wall Street hates nasty surprises, so the trick is managing expectations in the opposite direction.
Where things are not as bad as anticipated. Now, whether or not everything is purposely being guided more negative than in fact it is, I guess we'll never know the answer to that.
At Fort Pitt Capital Group, Chief Investment Officer Charles Smith has his own set of expectations. He says corporate America has been focused on cutting costs, so it ought to have something to show for that.
The bright side of 500,000 or 600,000 jobs lost every month is that earnings are going to be better than people expect.
That's provided, of course, that the weeks ahead don't end up living down to expectations. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Many years ago, developers in Brooklyn, New York, made big plans for the borough's central hub, known as Atlantic Yards. They included 16 buildings with millions of square feet for housing and offices and a basketball arena for the New Jersey Nets. The developers even hired renowned architect Frank Gehry to design the complex. But now Gehry's gone, and the plans have been scaled back sharply. Sally Herships reports.
The Atlantic Yards site lies in Brooklyn's District 35. Letitia James is the local city council rep. She's a big critic of the developer Forest City, and she hates the new architect's design for the basketball arena.
Now it's just a barn, an airplane hangar, a mess.
Some Brooklynites look at that so-called mess and get nervous about what their neighborhood might look like. But the recession could come to their rescue. Money has run so short that Forest City may not even be able to build the arena, let alone the office and residential buildings. Martin Filler is an architecture critic for the New York Review of Books. He says recessions can be a good thing for city skylines.
Well, not only does a recession not cause bad architecture, but in fact, I think it often has a salutary effect, what Daniel Patrick Moynihan once called benign neglect.
In other words, tough times mean less funding, which can prevent what Filler calls ill-conceived and ill-advised projects. He says architects on a budget often look more realistically at size, scale, and affordability.
That was certainly the case during the Great Depression, when bridges, highways, dams, housing, all kinds of wonderful initiatives took place.
The Atlantic Yards project may have looked wonderful to City Hall when it was proposed back in 2003. Gehry's model featured lots of glass and a soaring tower. But Brooklyn residents like Letitia James were more focused on issues like the threat of losing their homes through eminent domain. The last thing they need, she says, is another development cluttering the neighborhood, no matter how beautiful it might be.
What we do not need is a basketball arena for 20,000 fans who do not live in Brooklyn, who cannot afford the seats.
So it doesn't really matter who the architect is.
I could care less.
And it may not matter. Some area residents are suing for the right to stay, and New York's High Court of Appeals has accepted the case. A victory could sink the Atlantic Yards project for good and leave the Brooklyn skyline undisturbed. In Brooklyn, New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The unemployment rate is expected to top 10% by the end of this year, and that is pushing more people into financial distress. It's also changing the geography of poverty. More low-income people live in suburbs than cities now. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Rising levels of unemployment have been pretty much the same in cities and suburbs. Alan Berube is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution.
That's a change from previous recessions where the cities seemed to take it on the chin and the suburbs avoided the worst.
He says Chicago exemplifies the national trend. When Nixon was president, about a third of Chicago's poor lived in the suburbs. Now it's about half. 41-year-old Vanita Thomas is one of those people. She has an MBA and worked as an accountant until she was hospitalized for a serious illness. After that, she managed to find a few temp jobs until the economy went cold.
Nobody was hiring. You couldn't find a temp assignment. Everything went dead.
She went on unemployment, but that only lasted until the fall.
September, my unemployment's running out, and basically my landlord, he's saying, you're a nice tenant, but Ms. Thomas, if you can't afford the rent, I have to put you out.
A friend from her church let Thomas stay with her in the suburbs. When she still didn't have money for rent last January, Thomas had to move into a local shelter.
That day was like my ground zero because that's when the reality really hit me that I was homeless.
She lived dormitory style with roommates. Thomas was grateful to have a roof over her head, but angry about her circumstances.
Years back, they told you, go to school, get an education so you get a good job, so you would never have to worry about being in a situation like that. I kept saying, how can this happen to me?
Some of the increased poverty in the suburbs has happened gradually. Immigrants who traditionally settled in inner cities are increasingly moving directly to suburbs. That's where the jobs are, or were. Again, Alan Berube with Brookings.
this recession is going to perhaps accelerate the long-term trend toward the suburbanization of poverty.
Some of the suburban poor will bounce back. Vanita Thomas got a job with a call center. She earns less than she did as an accountant, but it's enough for an apartment, and she can set aside some money each month, aware that she's just a couple paychecks away from being homeless. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Thanks for joining us.
American Public Media.